Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. The U.S. Justice Department has decided to stop using private prisons. In an announcement this week, the agency said it concluded they're less efficient and less safe than government-run prisons. One of the companies that decision will impact is Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA. The company held a call this morning for jittery investors. KJZZ's Kerry Young was on it as well, and she joins me. And Kerry, what was the tone of this morning's call?
Generally, it seemed like company officials were trying to tell investors that there's no need to panic. The DOJ's announcement Thursday got quite a bit of media coverage, including here at KJZZ, and stock prices for CCA fell sharply. Actually, it started at about $27 that day and fell to $13 within a matter of hours. That has since rebounded today a little bit, though. But this did cause enough concern that the company leaders organized this call within 24 hours of that announcement. And to reassure investors, CCA President Damon Heiniger pointed out that these contracts made up about 7% of their total revenue, and that serving these agencies, you know, that they know they have varying levels of demand, and that's just a regular part of their business.
And to be honest with you, that is part of our value proposition, where we provide customized solutions for our partners as they need them, and those solutions could be short-term or long-term.
So, Kerry, there are obviously several privately run detention centers in Arizona. Will any of those be impacted by the DOJ memo?
So the short answer to that is no. The memo just impacts private prisons run by the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Right now, there are 13 facilities impacted by this, but none of them are actually in Arizona. So while we do have privately run detention centers in Arizona, those are either administered by the state or other federal agencies like the U.S. Marshals Service or Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Well, Kerry, what else did company leaders address on this call?
Well, first, they assured investors that this really didn't actually come as too much of a surprise to them. Over the last few years, the Federal Bureau of Prisons had been working to reduce its prison population. The memo said that the DOJ was directing the Bureau of Prisons to, quote, decline or substantially reduce their use of private prisons, which CCA President Heiniger said is different from completely eliminating. He also pointed out that there are three facilities that will still be in use for the foreseeable future, and those are mostly in Texas. He also addressed accusations that were included in some of the media reports about the quality of the facilities and that inmates might have been mistreated. He says those assertions are unfair and untrue.
These women and men are proud Americans who put on the CCA uniform or provide services and programs with our facilities. And they are from all walks of life, and nearly a fifth of them are former military or serve in our reserves. And they do an outstanding job in operating our facilities.
He also wanted to point out that Bureau of Prison staff monitor CCA facilities and their staff 24/7 and also report back regularly on quality.
Now, I understand officials did take questions from investors afterwards. What did they seem to be concerned with?
There were about three or four investors that chimed in with questions after the whole call was done, and some got into really specific details about upcoming contracts they knew about, if the company thinks this news will hurt their ability to negotiate, that kind of thing. Others wanted to know about other growth opportunities, given the shrinking market now with the Federal Bureau of Prisons. To answer that, Heiniger said that the memo will not impact contracts they hold with other federal agencies, like I mentioned, U.S. Marshals Service and ICE. He also pointed to opportunities with states.
So we've got a lot of meaningful activity going on the state side. And again, I think if we've got capacity, either existing or future capacity, then I think we'll have good demand as always.
According to Heiniger, they're anticipating 1% annual growth in their state-based contracts over the next couple years.
That's KJZZ's Kerry Young. Thanks, Kerry.
Thanks, Mark.
One group that's been pushing to eliminate the use of private prisons in the U.S. is the American Friends Service Committee. Caroline Isaacs is executive director of the group's Arizona branch in Tucson, and she joins me. Caroline, the Department of Justice's decision only affects 13 prisons at the federal level. Even with that limited scope, is this move impactful?
It's long overdue. It's not like the problems in these facilities were not known for years. But I think that the DOJ went about it in a very sensible and very measured way to do their own study, collect the data on the problems in the facilities and document them, and then lay out a path forward. It is hopefully a first step, and I think some of the statements could indicate that they may be looking at other federal contracts, like those with ICE and U.S. Marshals, and certainly many advocates across the country are calling for that. And the impact then on states like Arizona is certainly there.
Are you encouraged at the national level more than you would be in Arizona that there may be more progress to come whether the DOJ is under a Democratic or Republican administration?
That's a great question. I can only hope that any executive would look at the tremendous failure and waste of public funds on these contracts and conclude that they are not in the public interest. And that certainly applies here in Arizona as well. We've had years of data showing that we're losing money on our state investment in for-profit prisons.
When we focus on the faults of private prisons, do we in any way let publicly run prisons off the hook in a sense?
Yes, I'm so glad that you brought up that point. And I am the first to say that this is not a question of are private prisons better than public prisons? The question is, what is our best response overall to a variety of social problems? And you see this in the national move to end mass incarceration. And that's mass incarceration across the board. It's not that one kind of prison is better than another. It's what response to those social problems is really going to get us the best outcomes. And in many cases, that is not prison at all. The best practices in this field show that people should be held on the lowest level of supervision necessary for the shortest amount of time necessary. And we're seeing this now, fortunately, on the county levels, where in both Maricopa and Pima counties, you have these very robust efforts to get people out of jail quicker. And that's because the science shows that the longer people are held, the worse their outcomes are.
You talk about it's a good time to sort of look at the entire system. Does sentencing reform fit in there as well?
No question. That is the key. Is again to say, really, how are we doing in this area? And given that we have an over 60% recidivism rate in Arizona, it's pretty clear that what we've been doing isn't working, and it's costing us massive amounts of money. What I think the best utility of the DOJ decision is for states is that it provides a roadmap for how to get out from under these contracts.
Caroline Isaacs is Program Director for the American Friends Service Committee in Southern Arizona. And Caroline, thank you for the time.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Following months of meetings and conversations, Arizona's Task Force on Fair Justice for All has issued its report that includes 65 abbreviated recommendations. A number of them are focused on making the justice system more affordable. And with me to talk about the task force's list in more detail is Dave Byers, Arizona's Administrative Office of the Court's Director. He also is co-chair of the task force. Dave, the recommendations are generally focused on fairness. How did you aim to achieve that?
The task force made it clear that if a person breaks the law, there should be a sanction, regardless of what your income level is. You don't just get to break the law and not have a sanction. But that those sanctions can't be excessive. They have to be fair. They can't be so high that a person has no possibility of ever paying their fine. To do that is just to breed hopelessness in the system. And over the years, there have been a lot of surcharges and fees added to the basic fine, say, for a speeding ticket. And those have gotten pretty high. So the task force is recommending that, yes, there should be sanctions, but give the judges the discretion to mitigate or lower that fine, to be more reasonable, still have an impact on a person if they're low income, to deter the behavior, but not make it impossible for them to pay. The task force also recommended that judges and courts not be required to suspend a person's driver's license as a first resort. Instead, they're suggesting to be a last resort. People have come to realize that suspending a driver's license is just devastating. People need to drive their cars to get to work. And if you have if you're driving on a suspended license, that's a criminal offense. So what can start out as a simple speeding ticket, which is a civil matter, say a person doesn't come to court because they can't pay the fine or they believe they can't pay the fine, can quickly morph into a criminal matter if the license is suspended and a person then drives. So the task force recommended that that also be changed.
And Dave, number 22 on the list also struck me, which is consider increasing access to the court. For example, offering hours at night, weekends, or extending regular hours, taking the court to people in remote areas. How important would that be?
Well, it is important to a lot of people. You know, a lot of people work the same hours that courts are open, you know, 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. And for a lot of folks, taking off of work is very difficult, or they don't get paid when they take off work. So there's that extra cost. So finding ways to do things without having to physically come to court will be important. For example, if you're stopped and you don't have your insurance card with you, you now are required to come to court and show proof of that insurance. We're going to let citizens be able to take a picture of that on their phone and email it into the court as proof. We're also actually looking at, down the road though, but looking at ways that you could resolve disputes online.
And also on the list of abbreviated recommendations, number 61 was launch a public education campaign to support the adopted recommendations of the task force, and 62, provide a comprehensive and targeted educational program for all stakeholders. It does seem like the task force does its job. Recommendations come out. As you said, there are some other actions that may need to be taken, but then ultimately the community needs to know what's happened, right?
That's right. Not only the community, but the judges and all the people who are court personnel and law enforcement personnel, because the task force recommendations are a change in culture. People have been doing things a certain way for many, many years. And to change that for the better does take an education effort. You've got to show people the research. You've got to show them how there's better techniques to use. And it'll take a while to get that culture changed.
And Dave, finally, where do we go from here? How many steps would have to be taken in order to implement some of these? And are some of the recommendations much easier, perhaps, than others?
Yeah, the recommendations, I think, break into three areas. There's a number of things that courts can do just administratively. It's a matter of funding things, policy, and put them into practice. But there are a number of recommendations that will take rule changes. I expect a rule petition to the Supreme Court to be filed next week. And the court could consider those rules as early as the end of this year. And then legislative matters will be introduced in the legislature next session. And, of course, that's up to the pleasure of the legislature. Finally, there's one recommendation that might even require a change to the Constitution. That's going to take a little bit more study. But if that would occur, that would be before the people down the road a couple of years.
Dave Byers is Arizona's Administrative Office of the Courts Director. We've been talking about recommendations issued by Arizona's Task Force on Fair Justice for All. And, Dave, thanks.
Sure thing, Steve. Good luck.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody.
And with Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway, I'm Steve Goldstein.
I have the honor to announce that the games of the 31st Olympiad are awarded to the city of Rio de Janeiro.
Well, there we have jubilation in the hall. Rio de Janeiro has become the first South American city to win the right to host the Olympics.
Well, the Rio Olympics close on Sunday, just a couple of days left before the 2016 Games are all over. That sound is from 2009, when Jacques Rogge, the IOC president at the time, announced that Brazil had won those 2016 Games. This was way before Ryan Lochte and his gang of infantile swim bros terrorized a Rio gas station. Back then, Brazil was considered the country of the future, a young, diverse population, vast natural resources, seemingly solid governance, good financial outlook. All of the pieces were in place for Brazil to assume its place at the top of the world stage this very decade. And the 2014 World Cup and the 2016 Olympics were supposed to be the coming out party for that. But all of that, it seems, has been put on hold now. Brazil is reeling from a financial crisis, corruption scandals, and the ongoing impeachment proceedings of its suspended president, Dilma Rousseff. Joining me now to talk about what's next for Brazil is Lúcia Guimarães. She's a columnist and correspondent for O Estado de Sao Paulo. As impeachment proceedings begin against President Dilma Rousseff next week, Lúcia says that leaves Brazil with a lot of political turmoil.
If all goes as expected, because there's been a vote count and there are enough senators to vote for the impeachment that may happen on August 31st, then the interim president becomes the de facto president, and he has a huge task ahead, which is to try to achieve some sort of fiscal austerity, which he hasn't been able to, and his critics will say that he's not really trying that hard.
Forever, it seems like Brazil has been on the edge of greatness, the country of the future, and then never quite steps over the line. Have the games shown Brazilians, or the rest of the world for that matter, anything that would give them real optimism that they're going to finally cross over that threshold and have the kind of economy and the kind of political stability that they've been promised, it seems like, for 20 years?
I'm a little more pessimistic because I think things started really going down after 2009, that at the end of the second Lula term, he abandoned a lot of the responsible policies. And since then, I think the conditions for this maybe economic depression, something so, have been created. We now have officially 11.4% unemployment. Some say that's going to be maybe a lost decade for young people coming into the labor market. And we have intractable problems with Social Security accounts, with public spending. And the interim president, who may become the president for the next 2 years, hired a cracking economic team. I'm sure some are friends with Marcelo, but he seems very beholden to the political forces. And Brazilian Congress is really, everybody wants their pork, you know. So Michel Temer has not faced raises in public requests for raises by public servants. He has not been tough on renegotiating the state debt, which is a huge deal for the Brazilian economy, the individual state's debt. So I think there's a forecast of some growth next year, but I think it's a very long road, as you said. You know, we think we're getting there, and then we don't.
What have Brazilians learned, do you think, from the way the games have been put on? There was a lot of pessimism going into the games with construction and infrastructure, a lot of unrest in the political scene in Brazil. Are Brazilians taking away any optimism from the games coming off successfully? Does it matter to them?
It does matter. I think people were expecting much worse, but I'm from Rio and it's my town, and it's Rio now has 4% less unemployment, and as the games are over, unemployment will really come back up in Rio, and Rio is a very violent city, so I think it's more about Rio, the way Rio de Janeiro will be affected by it.
Lúcia Guimarães, she's columnist and correspondent for O Estado de Sao Paulo.
That's the Takeaways, Todd Zwillick.
A student missing school may not seem like a big deal, but when a student is disconnected from his or her school, absences and work multiply fast.
Now a new program is putting mentors to work in schools countywide to intervene in the lives of students who end up in truancy court before it's too late. The show's Lauren Gilger reports.
As soon as I know they're not in school, I text them and ask why he hasn't responded, so now I'm going to call.
It's late afternoon on a Thursday at Fremont Junior High School in Mesa, and Carolyn Contreras is making her last few calls of the day.
Especially with this being only the second week of school, if they're already missing, I'm concerned.
Contreras is a youth education mentor for the Maricopa County Education Service Agency. And she spends a lot of her time doing this, tracking people down and not getting very far.
His voicemail hasn't been set up yet.
You feel like you have to sort of, like, play detective often?
Oh, yeah.
She's one of six mentors who works with a large caseload of students across the county who have landed themselves in court for truancy or other issues. They work to help get them back in the classroom.
Hey, you're not at school. I'm going to call you. And guess what? If you don't answer, I'm going to come by your house.
It's part of a program that's attempting to head off a much larger problem that often starts with kids missing school and turns into chronic truancy, a status offense in Maricopa County.
Nationally, we have an absenteeism of about 13%. In Maricopa County, it's 16.
Maricopa County School Superintendent Don Covey worked with the County Board of Supervisors to fund the program last year because there are more students missing more than 15 days of school a year here than most everywhere else.
But we have some traditional schools that have an absentee rate as much as 63%.
Some alternative schools in the county have rates as high as 80%.
Those are alarming statistics.
It's Caroline, your education mentor with Maricopa County. I just wanted to touch base with you. I sent you a few texts, but I was...
Contreras spent the first 8 years of her career as a teacher, but now she says she's able to dig deeper with students who might have slipped through the cracks before.
I'm able to get to the root of the problem. Why aren't they in school? What's going on? What is it home? Is it school?
She works with students on problem solving, organization, and setting short-term achievable goals. And she's big on positive reinforcement.
One student I had, he was really struggling behavior and academically. And we started writing goals. And every time he met a goal, I would bring him a piece of candy. And I know it sounds very little, but that piece of candy meant the world to him.
She texts students at 6:30 in the morning to remind them to get up for orientation. She tracks them down at home when they're not in school. She works with administrators on shaping their class schedules. But she finds most of the time these students stop showing up for one simple reason.
Who cares if I'm at school? Who's going to notice?
A lot of it is, so what? What's the difference? You know, what do you care?
Cheryl Newser is the assistant principal at Fremont Junior High, one of the schools where Contreras works.
When you look at kids who are failing classes, we then look at, you know, how many absences have they had. There's definitely a correlation.
She says teachers at her school have anywhere from 120 to 180 students each. They can't make sure every single student has caught up on every single assignment, and the work adds up fast.
Sometimes they have to hit the wall where they're in trouble, they're failing all their classes, things are a mess, and then they get it. Like a light bulb goes on, you know. And I just think for some of them, it's a matter of whether there's one person they can talk to and one person they can turn to who is in their corner.
And for many of them, that person is a mentor, like Contreras. Last year, she started working with one student who she says missed more classes than he made.
Today, I met with him and I was looking at a schedule with him.
He's really into auto shop.
First hour, he had welding and he said, "It's excellent. I love it."
And his last class of the day, auto shop.
So I said, "Do you understand what your counselors and administration did here?"
She told him they bookended his day with classes he would love so he would come to school and stay.
And he kind of looked at me and I'm like, "Do you understand how much they cared?" He had this look that I've never seen. Like, I'm going to get teary-eyed right now. Truly, he was like, "Oh, yeah." And he got it, and it clicked.
Contreras says she has a lot of hard days in this job, but not today.
Yeah, it was. It was a pretty good day.
In Mesa, Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
Last year, we told you about how researchers were trying to figure out why the Four Corners area was such a hot spot for methane. Well, now they've got some answers. They determined there are more than 250 sources of methane, but that a small number of them are responsible for about half of the emissions. Christian Frankenberg is a research scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena and has been working on this. And Christian, first off, just how big is this hot spot?
From space, it's hard to say because this spatial resolution from this using the spaceborne instruments is kind of restricted to their individual footprints, which is on the order of 60 by 30 kilometers. So what we basically saw using this kind of fuzzy picture that we can only see from space was that the area of enhancements was kind of in the order of maybe 100 times 100 kilometers roughly. That was basically the focus area.
Do we know what's causing it?
From the initial study, we couldn't really say what's causing it. We could only kind of speculate what the reason for this enhancement is because it's in principle, the population density is relatively low. There's no wetlands that could emit methane and relatively little ruminants in this area. So the natural sources in this area are kind of restricted. But of course, we always speculated that it is related to natural gas extraction because the San Juan Basin, which is located in this area, is the largest coal bed methane producing area in the continental U.S. And this is the reason why we went there now last year in April, and we're basically flying imaging airborne spectrometers to enable a view instead of resolutions of 50 kilometers. We now have a spatial resolution of 1 to 3 meters, with which we then can really say where the plumes are coming from and what it really means.
Something that struck me as very interesting from your study is that 10% of the individual methane sources are contributing half of the emissions. So it sounds like not a lot of sources are contributing and causing a pretty big problem here.
This is right. Yeah, this is a so-called, this is what's related to the so-called heavy tail distribution, and it's basically being observed in many natural phenomena. But this can be a good message, because that basically means that if we focus on these bigger ones, we can really reduce overall fluxes pretty effectively instead of looking after thousands and thousands of individual wellheads.
So what do we have to do to make that happen, though?
In principle, we performed kind of the measurements and laid the groundwork, with a caveat also that it was a one-off shot, so these pictures might change in time a little bit as well. But in principle, now it would be up to other people to really decide what has to be done. And I think in principle, this is also a win-win situation with industry as well, because they also, they don't want these losses, because it's for them also lost revenue.
Is this hotspot something that those of us who live in the Four Corners area should be concerned about?
No, not really. I think I would rather move to the Four Corners area than live here in LA, where in the mega cities the air quality is definitely way worse. So methane itself is not really a dangerous gas or kind of an air quality gas in that sense that we have to restrict emissions from an air quality standpoint. It's really mostly a radiative forcing climate change agent, but it's not directly related to air quality directly.
Christian Frankenberg is a research scientist at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. We are talking about his research into the methane hotspot over the Four Corners region.
And a check of international news from KJZZ. The campaign for president here in the U.S. still has months to go, but countries around the world are weighing the possible outcome from their own interests.
Cuba is very interested in who the next leader of the U.S. will be and what it may mean for the rapidly thawing relations with Washington. The BBC's Will Grant reports.
Please rise for the raising of the flag and the national anthem of the United States.
A year has passed since one of the most extraordinary moments in the long and tangled history between the United States and Cuba. Since that day, the official reopening of the long-shuttered U.S. Embassy in Havana, a lot has happened between the former Cold War foes. Direct flights have been reinstated, travel restrictions eased for U.S. citizens, and they have increased cooperation in science and the arts. Plus, of course, there was an historic visit by President Obama.
Today, as the President of the United States of America, I offer the Cuban people el saludo de paz.
But while many Cubans would happily accept another 4 years of Mr. Obama, a new administration in Washington is coming.
Obviously, the big problem with the Cuban-U.S. relations is that the embargo is the elephant in the room.
Carlos Azugurai is a former Cuban diplomat. He says the key thing for the next phase of the United States' normalization with Cuba has to be the lifting of its decades-long economic embargo on the island.
The elephant has started to go out of the room. You already have the nose out with the opening of the Sheraton hotels, with the credit cards that can be used in Cuba. The travel restrictions have been eased. If the Democrats get control of Congress back, they're bound to do something about the embargo.
So how would a Clinton or a Trump presidency affect the thaw in relations?
We have to seize this moment.
First, Hillary Clinton, who said this at a speech in Miami.
The Cuba embargo needs to go once and for all.
She also said she encouraged President Obama to engage with Cuba when she was Secretary of State. Yet many ordinary Cubans don't entirely trust her and remember how she supported her husband's decision to tighten restrictions on Cuba as president. As for Mr. Trump, his foreign policy position on Cuba isn't entirely clear yet, though it may come as little surprise that he differs from many in his party on the issue. This was in a televised debate on CNN earlier this year.
What I want is I want a much better deal to be made. I don't agree with President Obama. I do agree that something should take place. After 50 years, it's enough time, folks.
Just to be clear,
the mediator then pushed him on whether he'd close the U.S. embassy or continue President Obama's policy of rapprochement.
I would probably have the embassy closed until such time as a really good deal was made and struck by the United States.
The first people affected by such a radical step would be the diplomats in Havana themselves. The U.S. chargé d'affaires in Cuba is Jeffrey De Laurentiis.
My wish is that when the campaign is over and the election is over and whoever is elected president is in the White House, he or she will recognize the value of the direction that we have taken and will wish to continue it.
For the time being, the Cuban diplomats who deal with Washington are remaining tight-lipped too. Josefina Vidal heads the U.S. Affairs Department at the Cuban Foreign Ministry.
We expect that whomever is the next president of the United States will take into consideration what the majority of the American public opinion thinks about this, what the majority of the Cuban American population in the United States thinks about this, and when you look at the polls, the majority are in favor of the normalization of relations between Cuba and the United States.
Josefina Vidal of the Cuban Foreign Ministry ending that report by the BBC's Will Grant in Havana.
The Goldwater Institute this week filed suit against Chandler over the city's sign code. The institute is representing a group of property and business owners who argue the rules violate their constitutional rights to free speech and equal protection. Goldwater Institute Adi Dinar is working on this case, and he joins me. And Adi, what's your complaint with how Chandler regulates its signs?
In April of this year, we had published a policy paper urging cities, including Chandler, to take a hard look at their sign code to bring it into compliance with the Supreme Court's decision in the case against the town of Gilbert. Not only did Chandler not take any steps to amend its code, it continued to take enforcement actions against property owners and small businesses in the city. And that's what prompted this action.
So what are you hearing from some of the business owners in Chandler who I presume have come to you and said, hey, this is a problem?
Yes, we have heard a lot of concerns from business owners, because imagine you're a small business owner and want to put up a sign saying veterans discounts or sign language interpreters wanted or daycare discounts for single parents available. Such signs are currently illegal in Chandler. You could be fined up to $20,000 or jailed for 6 months, and that's a serious matter.
The case you referenced with the town of Gilbert had to deal with a church that had a sign out for Sunday services, and basically there were different rules for that kind of sign than for other types of signs. In reading through the complaint, it sounds like basically your argument is that Chandler's sign code is overly complex, and there are basically too many categories of signs. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, and in addition to that, under the sign code, the exclusive way to draw distinctions between different types of signs, the exclusive way to categorize these signs is to read the sign to determine what it says. And that kind of a content-based evaluation, the court said in the town of Gilbert case, should meet the strictest standards available under the Constitution.
So it's not so much that, for example, all like sandwich board signs are one category, or all temporary sale discount kind of signs are one category. It's actually what is specifically on the sign that is how the city determines whether or not it's okay?
That's exactly right. So, for example, if you had a sign that said for lease, then that is probably considered a real estate sign. But if the exact same sign said for lease with a direction mark on it, it would probably be an open house sign, and a different set of rules and restrictions would apply. And what the city is really doing here is categorizing the signs and then picking and choosing winners and losers in the marketplace of ideas. So once a government starts valuing signs based on its content, then courts in that kind of a situation have repeatedly said that the city has to come up with a really compelling reason to make those kinds of distinctions.
So what ideally would you like for Chandler to do here?
We would like Chandler to have a truly content-neutral sign code, And the town of Gilbert case itself laid out several options that the city can look at and try to implement in their sign code that would make it truly content neutral.
Have you had any conversations with Chandler about this?
Yes.
And how have those gone?
They have gone well. I mean, we have continued to urge them to take a hard look at their sign code and amend their sign code to bring it into compliance with Reed versus Town of Gilbert. And really, the Reed decision came out in June of 2015, and it has been over a year, and there has been no action on part of the city to move in that direction.
Adi Dinar is an attorney at the Goldwater Institute, which is suing Chandler over its ordinances regulating signs. We also reached out to the city of Chandler on this story. In an email, a spokesman says the city is not yet in a position to comment on the lawsuit.
Law enforcement is in the national spotlight in conversations about officer-involved shootings and ways to improve tense relations between police departments in the communities they work in. Some police departments, like Peoria, have programs that aim to improve community relations. The show's Annika Klein takes us to the Citizens Police Academy.
What are we going to do? Anybody have any ideas?
Standing in full blue uniform, Commander Douglas Steele sounds more like a teacher as he addresses a room of about 30 people seated at long tables. They're working out a hypothetical problem. An elderly woman has had multiple windows broken in her home.
And again, nothing's wrong here, guys. You can throw out anything. We can say we're going to make it all bulletproof. We can't afford it, but it's definitely something to come up with. But yes.
The group here ranges from young adults to retirees. They'll meet once a week for 3 months to learn about the department from top to bottom.
They just see it in a whole different light.
Lisa Maddox coordinates the academy. She says it's been offered for more than two decades as a way to educate the public about what police officers do every day.
We see things in the media, and we might not be seeing the whole picture, but we form an opinion from that one scenario.
That's become more of a concern for police departments everywhere as cities across the country make national headlines for extremely tense relations between law enforcement and community members. And it hasn't been lost on the participants here, like Robert Sheets.
The things that are going on nationally with law enforcement, that probably pushed me into coming to this class a little more just to find out how the police feel about the things that are going on with Black Lives Matter and so forth.
The questions the class asks are very specific to their neighborhoods. Sheets says he has concerns about increases in officer response times in Peoria and the department's struggle to hire more cops.
The city of Peoria is growing so rapidly, especially up north, and they definitely need more cops for sure.
He says last week they covered that topic, and this week they're going behind the scenes of the number everyone knows but hopes they never have to call.
This is 911 emergency. Or is there an emergency there? We got a 911 hang up.
I wanted to see the different areas of the department and have a better sense of what happens behind the scenes.
Amy Nichols is a mother and an author and unfortunately has been on the other side of the call a few times.
There have been traffic accidents and then a couple of medical situations. So, yeah, it's nice to get to see the people behind the scenes. It's comforting, actually.
And you said no other weapons in the home?
In coming weeks, they'll learn about crisis negotiation, vehicle stops, and body cameras. Last month, the department issued a camera to every officer in the field. Even though the academy is about law enforcement, Commander Douglas Steele wants the class to know real solutions are often not about force at all.
Put more cops. We call it cops on dots. Guys, that doesn't solve a problem. I can make the problem move. Hey, I have a crime problem. Put all the cops there, and all I do is displace it.
For the elderly lady with the broken windows, the group comes up with all kinds of solutions that don't have to do with cops on dots, like asking if she attends a church that could help fix her windows and set her up with a security system. And when the group graduates from the Citizens Academy, Lisa Maddox says they can become one of those solutions by talking to other residents about what really goes on in the department.
They're able to answer questions that the public has, share information, put them in contact with us.
And she says this year, they created an alumni association for graduates of the program. Their first order of business was to raise money for victims of crime. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
As fall approaches, the Valley's hotels and restaurants are gearing up for a busy tourist season this year. And as KJZZ's Carrie Young reports, officials in several Valley cities expect tourism to finally reach pre-recession levels.
If you walk down East Indian Plaza in Scottsdale around 1 a.m. on any given weekend, chances are it's going to sound a lot like this. Right now, this crowd is mostly Valley residents, but in a few months, the area will be teeming with tourists.
We get a lot of Canadians from Quebec and Montreal, Toronto, mostly East Coast. We get a lot of Chicago, Dallas, Kansas City.
Ryan Hibbert is the CEO of Riot Hospitality Group, an organization that owns three restaurants and bars in the Scottsdale area. He says over the last 5 years, business has been steadily growing.
There's been a huge transformation in people's spending patterns. Initially, when I first built El Jefe, probably in about 2010, I built it to basically be based on volume.
And now he says people are spending almost double.
It is kind of a little mini Vegas, in my opinion, but it's definitely got some room to grow.
Scottsdale, a mini Vegas? Leah Diamond, a managing partner of the Lux Transportation Company, says she may not go that far, but
a lot of people really know about golf. That seems to be one of the top trenders, especially among men that come in.
She adds the area's restaurants and bars are a popular request among her clients.
We see a lot of East Coast travel for bachelor and bachelorette parties, and also a lot of pre-wedding parties.
Dr. Kathleen Anderek is the director of community resources at Arizona State University. She says there has been a steady increase of visitors to the Valley over the last 5 years, and those tourists are traveling longer distances to get here.
So we could very well see that influx of people from farther away just based on the improving economy.
And in this post-recession economy, Anderek says people are now visiting Arizona for more than just outdoor adventures like the Grand Canyon. The restaurant scene in the Valley is also starting to earn a name for itself outside of state lines.
Part of the interest I think we're seeing in things like the arts and food and culture is that we're getting a critical mass within a number of areas.
According to a report from the State Tourism Office, Phoenix and Central Arizona have seen steady gains in total travel-related spending since 2010, growing by nearly 19%. By 2015, travelers spent roughly $1.36 billion in the area. Breaking that down a little, last year Scottsdale saw roughly 8.6 million visitors. There were more than 4 million in Tempe, and overall in the Phoenix metro, more than 19 million people came. So while places like the Grand Canyon are still commanding the top spots for tourism in the state, Anderek says you shouldn't count the greater Phoenix area out either.
People actually want to stay down here when they come and visit and do the kinds of things that are down here, you know, First Friday and the other, you know, the sports events, the performing arts that are down here.
And barring any economic crisis or controversial political decision, she says the trend is expected to grow. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Musical tastes are dramatically different, and songs and how they come about evolve and change over the years, from classical to jazz to rock to hip-hop. In a similar sense, instruments gain in popularity and then nearly fade away. Colin O'Donohoe is world maestro of the Phoenix-based Pangean Orchestra, a diverse collection of musicians and instruments. O'Donohoe is one of two Americans who will be in Amsterdam beginning on August 27th for Atlas Lab, where he'll join other musicians from around the world to study, play, and research intercultural music. And he joins me now. Colin, what are some of the instruments used by the Pangean Orchestra?
Things that really grab people's eye, grab people's attention, would be instruments like the veena, which is from India, the pipa, which is a Chinese instrument, it's a lute. Ali Kamil, he's always a star at the shows. He's from Iraq. He's actually a refugee from that war, and he plays the kanun. Saman Mahmoudi, he plays the santur, and he is from Iran. There's Eric Zhang, who plays a lot of Middle Eastern flutes like the ney. And then on the Western side, I think one of the things that makes Pangean Orchestra successful is the blending. We have Dr. Rose French, who runs the Milaf Chamber Players. She plays French horn. And I found that the colors in the French horn really act as a bridge to get some of the sounds that we might not be used to as Westerners.
When people think of an orchestra, they think about the blending of these what may be disparate sounds into something that sounds as if they were always meant to be together. How does it come together that all these different instruments, Western or otherwise, come together to form a coherent sound that people want to listen to, that they're passionate about?
Right. So that's a great question. And it goes to the idea that we're used to hearing the orchestra, but when the orchestra was new, and if you think back a couple hundred years, it was a new idea. So back then it wasn't, oh, of course this makes sense. Back then it was revolutionary. So what we're doing today in Pangean Orchestra is the same exact thing that people did 250 years ago. That was revolutionary, you know, to put people together, whether the Baroque period, classical period. That was this crazy idea. What, you're going to mix this with this? No way. How's that going to sound? So it took amazing composers, it took amazing musicians, and it took just a lot of visionaries to do that. And we take it for granted today that you go to Phoenix Symphony, and of course that makes sense. We take that for granted. Pangean Orchestra, we're at the forefront of what the 21st century orchestra will be. And if we are successful and others follow suit around the country and around the world, then you give us 100 years or 150 years and they'll say, oh, of course that makes sense. My challenge as maestro is to find those commonalities between the instruments so we can achieve a sound that's pleasing to people's ears today.
So what sort of reception does the orchestra get when you travel to other places?
One thing I've found through my travels, when I was in Ireland, I found not a lot of Irish music. I found 21 Pilots, then I found Nicki Minaj and Western music being pumped through the streets. And I went into one pub and I finally heard Irish music. I heard Dropkick Murphys. That's not Irish, they're actually from Massachusetts. So I had to hear an American band play Irish music for me while I was in Ireland. That's akin to me going into an Americana restaurant, having a group from Belfast play Woody Guthrie. it was absurd. So that just highlights the point that world music is important because even in their own countries, they're not being respected. It's not the United States, it's the world. So we need to find ways to make these instruments relevant so that people want to listen to them.
Colin, that begs sort of the devil's advocate question then, because some people will say the dodo bird went extinct for a reason. How important is it in order to preserve the integrity, preserve the idea of these instruments still going on? How much do you think is dependent upon finding new ways to use the instruments and blending them in a way that the Pangean Orchestra does? Does it need that in order to move on to the next stage?
I believe it does. I believe that the instruments are not just an instrument, but they are the people that played them, that invented them. They're the people that for centuries have handed it down father to son, father to son. If the instrument goes extinct, then the people go extinct, the culture goes extinct, and we have this westernization that just takes over the planet. And I think that makes for a really boring place to live. So I think, you know, on the one level, preserving it for the sake of preserving it, I don't think is a good method, and that's not what I approach. The way I approach it is we need to preserve these instruments, but it needs to be relevant to people so that they want it to be preserved so we can gain a momentum. But if you let a krar, a kora, a rabab, the ilan pipes, if you let them go extinct, you lose the history and it's gone forever.
Colin O'Donohoe is world maestro of the Phoenix-based Pangean Orchestra. He's heading to Amsterdam next weekend to join other world musicians as part of an effort to study, play, and research intercultural music. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.